We're talking with William Henry, who's an investigative mythologist. We're talking about Rennes, Le Chateau, where he just got back from, but we're more than that, kind of moving forward a little bit into his research into the possibility that the ancients may have had access to technology which we haven't even mastered yet, especially in the form of being able to open and close wormholes. Wormholes in space and time. Being able to manage space and time through a series of ancient inventions, which are clearly illustrated. If you, like an investigative mythologist, know where to look, we'll tell you more about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And just a reminder, on the website, coasttocoastam.com, there is a there's a link to my blog. If you missed crypto news earlier in the show, in the first hour, you can go take a look at that right now. I posted it up on my IP Freely blog. And while you're there, too, you can scroll back a little bit and read some of the past blogs. But I want to make a promise to you. I haven't really fully decompressed yet on the 35W bridge collapse and all that's been going on this week. So many people wrote kind letters and asking interesting questions. And keep an eye on that blog in the days and the weeks ahead. And I think we'll go back to some of the letters that you all have written, some of the observations that you've made, some of the questions that you've asked. And I thank you for that kind of inspiration. So not done with it yet, but a blog will be appearing shortly back on the 35W bridge collapse and all that has happened up here in the Twin Cities, coming up on coasttocoastam.com. In the meantime, William Henry and your calls about an hour from now on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So I guess in one way we'll never know for sure whether or not the ancient Egyptians had access to wormholes, but I guess it leads open the possibility that one of these days they could pierce the space-time continuum and just kind of show up here and prove it. Right?
I love it, Ian. Yeah, that's great. I mean, there is always a promise that these beings will one day return. And so it's really incredible, though. I mean, my basic premise, Ian, is that when you look back at this artwork, particularly, say, at Abydos in Egypt, where you find the incredible artwork in the Chapel of Osiris there that portrays what appears to be some kind of an ancient particle accelerator on one wall, and then on the opposite wall you see the transformation or transfiguration of the king, the pharaoh Seti, into a being of light as he's going through this wormhole. You're looking at this and saying, wow, it looks like we've awakened, if you will, or returned to a level of intellect where we can understand what this imagery is saying. And the benefit of looking back is that today we have such a focus on technology that we're going to use our technology to, in a sense, conquer nature. And what we find is that the ancients had a very different approach to it. They focused on the spiritual connection that they had with nature and the transformation of themselves. They knew that this human flesh and bone is not going anywhere relative to wormholes. We're not going to open a wormhole like in the movie Stargate or Contact that a human being can actually travel through. Not going to happen.
Okay, but why not? I mean, why can't, if you say, I mean, if in a world of possibilities, why do you say that can't happen?
Well, I mean, they talk about the incredible energy that's present and the exotic matter that is present in these wormholes, and that would just literally rip the human body apart. And I also say that because invariably, when you're looking or reading about depictions in the ancient world of the quote-unquote gods who are accessing or utilizing these gateways, they are typically not in flesh and blood form. They are undergoing a transformation preparatory to this experience, sort of like Elijah before he goes into the whirlwind. He transmits the knowledge of that whirlwind to his priest, Elisha. And in fact, that image of Elijah's whirlwind is one of the key symbols of the Cathars as well, and they connected the the transfiguration of Elijah into a being of light with the light ship of Isis, and they connected it with that column of glory, the column of light, which I wanted to mention also that they also called that column the Christ column.
Well, that's interesting, and I'll get back to that, but I guess I'm still not quite certain then what we're talking about, and only because I think this is infinitely interesting, if you pardon the term, that what you're suggesting is that anybody that would have been able to have utilized the ancient ability to go into a wormhole would have had to have, what, somehow purified their physical body or dehumanized their physical self in some way that would have made them able to travel through that? Or
yes, it's not, in fact, a dehumanizing process, Ian. It's rather, they think of it as an ultra-humanizing process. They think of this as the next step. Again, they think of the human body as a caterpillar, and
right,
we're in a pupal form, and
right,
that what we're going to one day do is utilize this body for perhaps what they claim is the intended purpose for it, to act as a sort of a ladder or stairway for the soul to return to its source. And in this scenario, this body is an intermediate form. And in fact, it is a step in the process of becoming a light being. In Tibet, they call this the great perfection, where the lamas learn the process whereby they can alter the vibration of their body and transfigure themselves into a vortex of energy and then travel the cosmos. It's very interesting that the Cathars claim that much of their knowledge came from the East, and they upheld their masters as the perfecti, aligning them with the great perfection tradition of Tibet and suggesting that maybe that's what the Cathars were practicing, is this same tradition of altering the vibration of the body and turning it into a being of light.
Okay, but if the ancient Egyptians could really do this, or the Cathars for that matter, could really travel through these wormholes or perfect themselves so physically that they could bend space and time, if you will. I mean, that whole concept, you know, kicks such historical ass that you can't even begin to put your mind around it, except to say, why did they disappear? If they came to have this great ability, why do they quote unquote die off?
Why don't we have
them here still?
Ian, they were exterminated by the Catholic Church in the first European genocide. As many as 1 million men, women, and children Cathars were burned in cathedrals en masse by the Catholic Church to prevent this knowledge from being propagated. The Tibetans who possess this knowledge are persecuted by the Chinese. It seems that whenever this revelation is coming forward, there is an opposing force, a force of darkness, if you will, that seeks to prevent this knowledge from being shared by the general populace. And over again, when you see it, you find genocide attached to it.
Well, I'm not sure I'll go with you on the idea that I know the Cathars were pursued as part of
history. It's
yeah, I get that. But I don't know about a million. I don't know about a million, but I'll go
That's
with you because I know it. I know it happened. I just don't know about a million in the cathedrals. But that having been said, why not the
mass? They take 10,000 people and pack them, men, women, and children, in a cathedral and burn them, just like we're burning babies in Darfur today. The Church did this in the 13th century. And this is why even when you go to France today, there is still residual impact from that. People don't want to talk about this for fear of retaliation.
Well, I'm happy to talk about it. I guess what I'm saying is, even if we predate all of that, we go back to the Egyptians, what happened to the Egyptians? That predates any sort of organized...
The Egyptians had a 5,000-year-old civilization.
Right.
And civilizations tend to die out. I can't explain, maybe there was over the course of time, these teachings simply dissipated. People forgot. I mean, that's kind of the rap that's made on our civilization. We have all this great stuff, but we've really forgotten who we are as beings of love and light, and we have a civilization based on suffering and terror and things like this instead of a culture and a civilization that's based upon the upholding of the individual and the self and the ultimate possibility that we can become these ascended beings. And so maybe just over time, the 5,000-year-old civilization like Egypt, these ideas just sort of people forget over time. The other explanation, Ian, is really interesting, even more than that. It's that we live in a galaxy that experiences time cycles where we go through periods of light and periods of darkness, and we're leaving presently a period of darkness and entering, according to many, an era of light. And perhaps that's why these teachings are becoming so readily available today.
The subject, I mean, the idea of these ancient technologies is one of your DVDs, and it's it's very interesting how you use the ancient images and build on those using computer and, you know, sort of, I guess, 3D type imaging from your partner on that. That you go into detail about the Temple of Solomon as a kind of its own sort of accelerator, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's such a bizarre idea that when you have this incredible revelation that occurs in the first century AD, and the primary locale of this revelation is the Temple of Solomon. Most of the New Testament events, the important ones, the crucifixion and the resurrection, the tomb, the garden, are all right there on the hillside near Solomon's Temple. But we don't really talk about Solomon's Temple. And one of the key things that scholars don't talk about in particular is the fact that Solomon's Temple at the time of Jesus had what appears what would today look to be a 10 to 12 story tower or porch in front of it that was lined with gold. And you have to wonder, what were they doing with a 10 to 12 story tower hanging off of Solomon's Temple? Were they utilizing it for some advanced spiritual purpose, perhaps some alchemical purpose? And what I've done is looked at this story and said, okay, so Solomon and David, the King Solomon and his father, King David, were on a quest to recover the ancient relics of the Israelites, including the Ark of the Covenant, which is the purpose for which Solomon's temple was built. In addition, we're told that Solomon openly worshipped Asherah at the Temple of Solomon once he built it. Asherah is simply another word for Osiris. And Osiris in ancient Egypt was a device that stood around 10 to 12 stories tall, according to ancient Egyptian artwork. It had as its base a platform that looks exactly like the biblical Ark of the Covenant, or rather, the biblical Ark of the Covenant looks exactly like the platform upon which an enlightenment pillar, as it was called, stood and formed the complete Osiris device. So what I'm wondering is it possible that if Solomon's openly worshiping Asherah, Osiris, at Solomon's temple, did David or Solomon, in fact, go to Egypt and recover this original Osiris or Asherah device, which the Egyptians, by the way, said functioned as a bond between heaven and earth, a stairway to heaven, and did they bring it to Jerusalem, and were they, in fact, operating it, and was this technology then utilized at the time of Jesus and Mary Magdalene? And is this why we have this incredible tower, a sleeve, if you will, that covers this device?
What do you suspect it would be used for typically in an ancient Hebrew worship service?
To communicate with the deity. It was portrayed as an antenna because that appears to be one of its functions. The Egyptians talk about the divine water, the divine spirit that flowed through this pillar. And what we have to, and it also had a head attached to it, indicating that this head was capable of speaking. It was literally like an oracle. People would come to this place and receive teachings from this pillar. So there's many possibilities for what the Egyptians were doing with it. They left, in fact, a catalog of the uses for this device. It was a communications device. It held the soul of their savior, whom they called Osiris. It was a bond between heaven and earth, a ladder to heaven. These are all the terms that they utilized for this device, and we have to ask if this was the technology that later became known as the Ark of the Covenant, which was referred to by the Israelites as a communications device, possibly as a power supply, and also as a weapons system.
As a weapons system, then it would seemingly have met its match in the spears and the slingshots of the invading Roman army.
Not necessarily. I mean, when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, they carted all this stuff up and took it back to Rome, stayed there only for a short time, and whereupon the Visigoths came and got it and took it to Rennes-le-Château, according to...
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if they had it weapons technology like that, that was that cosmic, you would think they would have been able to have focused it and used it to defend itself, to defend the temple from the invading Romans.
Well, at this time, you probably had priests that did not know how to use it. I mean, there was a purification process and intense initiation that went along with the utilization of these devices. And so it's possible that that's an explanation for why they couldn't use it. It's also interesting to think that, well, if you have this technology, you don't have to use it. If you're an invading Roman army, for example, you grab it and you withhold it from others, and that's just as good as actually using it in some cases.
Okay. But I guess I and maybe I'm, you know, focused on the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but the idea that somehow if one lines up the right implements and elements of these of this ark, for example, one could bring about, you know, a kind of devastating divine power here on Earth. And it sounds like that's what you're hinting at as the potential capability of that, of the tower on the in the Temple of Solomon, in which case you would think they would have been able to have used it against the Nazis of their era, the invading Roman army intent on tearing down the temple.
Well, and here's where you have the dual aspect of it too, Ian. When the Egyptians are portrayed using the Osiris device, they are portrayed serving food to it. They're serving fruit to it, indicating that they used it for peaceful purposes. And so it may well be that the priests, too, that were utilizing this at the time of Jesus and Mary Magdalene were also seeking to utilize it for peaceful purposes as opposed to a instrument of mass destruction, which it's also capable of. And so I guess it depends on the intent of the people that were there. It's a good point, and I will I'll continue researching that and pondering it.
Yeah, I just look at it because I think it's really one of the seminal events, both in obviously in the history of Judaism, but also then shortly thereafter in Christianity as well. There's so many there's so many things that pivot right around that time during the invasion of the Romans, and it one wonders in light of where history ended up that they couldn't have used that technology effectively to keep away who were perceived to be at least by the Essenes as being, you know, the children of the dark, right? The children of the dark ones, the Roman army.
You bring up the Essenes too, Ian. They did not like the Temple of Solomon. They built other temples in Egypt, and it's kind of interesting to think, well, okay, what was it that they didn't like about it? Maybe, in fact, it wasn't operating at its full potential as they had hoped, and they took off into the desert to create a duplicate of their own and weren't successful at it.
Well, perhaps, but also the Essenes were sort of they were kind of the fringe element. I mean, they had their own gate at the temple. We know that. So they were accepted, and they went in through their own gate. But they had they were kind of edgy. You know, as the ancient Hebrews go, they had some non-traditional beliefs by the perception of the Orthodox, and so maybe that's why, you know, they didn't feel as welcome at the temple, but yet they were still given their own gate. They could still go.
Right. And again, this conversation is so relevant because so many people are beginning to think that we're in a quote-unquote end time when we're going to see the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple, Solomon's Temple 3. And so this is why I think we have to really get this right, because if this is going to happen, then we have to bring all the pieces together.
Okay.
And I'm sorry?
No, actually, we're just wrapping up into this hour, so we can leave that right there, and that kind of brings us into the rod and the ring discussion, too, which I'd like to get into with William Henry in the next half hour before we start getting to your phone calls. I will say this, though, that if they're going to do a Solomon's Temple 3, they have a long way to go to be as good as the Bourne Ultimatum, the third in the Bourne movie, you know, series. That was good. But well, then we'll pick that up in just a second with the William Henry, the rod and the ring. Where does that come into this? Going back both to this concept of divine symbols as particle accelerators and the divine physics of ancient cultures next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So the rod and the ring and the God particle, how do they all interplay in the dimensions of the blessed? We'll talk about that with William Henry, investigating both the symbolism and also the meaning of ancient art and the ancient iconography, which leads us to, well, to inventions that we haven't even mastered yet. But perhaps they did at one time. Is it a coincidence that they all still revolve around the rod and the ring? Investigative mythologist William Henry doesn't think so. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, all of this fancy book learning wouldn't mean a thing if we couldn't somehow transform ourselves into these divine-like beings. And we'll get to that still coming up with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM, who joins us back in this discussion about the rod and the ring. And I didn't want to cut you off where you were because you were just going to an interesting place, but I hate it just when it gets really super interesting, then I got to stop. So I felt better to grab you before you got to the precipice.
Thank you, Ian.
So let's talk about the rod and the ring. And if you want to tie that back into just where I cut you off, that's fine too. But I thought your point about how particle accelerators all still maintain that same design, and that those two symbols, that brings us back to sort of the early ancient church paintings and depictions of the gospel story too.
Yeah, you know, where I started with this, Ian, was about 10 years ago. I had been chasing FDR and his mystic guru named Nicholas Roerich around Mongolia as they were looking for the reincarnated Jesus and the secrets of the Holy Grail at a place called Shambhala, which has as its center a place called Mount Meru, which is the ladder or stairway to heaven, the axis to heaven in the east. And I found this diagram of Mount Meru, which is on the Coast to Coast site this evening. And I was giving a presentation on the subject once, and a scientist came up to me and said, that's a blueprint for a particle accelerator. And I had no idea what a particle accelerator was at that time, nor had I visited one, but I followed up on his suggestion, and lo and behold, that's exactly what this diagram from the second century in China could actually be, is a rod-like particle accelerator, an instrument that high-energy physicists use today to smash particles together so that they can learn the ultimate secrets of matter. And in fact, I was recently in touch with a PhD in physics who is the sort of the big brain, if you will, at one of the major weapons contractors in the United States. And I got his comments on the diagram, and he in detail told me exactly why this diagram from the second century can be interpreted as a particle accelerator. So starting from that place, I just asked the question, is it possible that the ancients did possess this kind of sophisticated consciousness that could breed this kind of technology? And the answer seems to be, yes, they did.
Well, what did they use it for? I mean, it sounds like the ancients like inventing a electric washing machine without something to plug it into.
Well, they inevitably did have power sources, people believe. The Great Pyramid, for example, is considered to be a giant power plant. What they used it for is as a ladder or stairway to heaven. But here's the interesting thing about it. When you look at, for example, the diagram of Meru, the ladder to heaven from second century Mongolia, or China rather, you look at it, it clearly resembles a human spinal cord and a vertebrae system. And what you recognize is that it appears they were making a connection between this technology out here and what is contained within our body. And so if we begin to think of our body as this actual technology, we see how the ancients actually used it. They see, many of these ancient cultures had a belief in something that we have kind of lost touch with, and that's the idea that within us we have something they referred to as the divine spark or the divine particle. The philosophers called it the philosopher's stone. And this is an aspect of ourselves that lays dormant until we begin the process of schooling or educating ourselves, initiating ourselves, if you will, in the esoteric secrets of our body. And what they claim is that our body is to be utilized for by this divine spark is a ladder or stairway to heaven. And what we're charged with doing is learning how to activate these latent capabilities within our body and use the body as a conductor between heaven and earth.
Okay, well, take me through that a little bit more, though. What is it that would happen? Typically, how would you enter into one, and or what would be the – would you have – was this for the implementation or the implanting of a divine spark, or is this – was this an extraction device? I mean –
Yeah, that's a very good term, Ian. I think of it as an extraction device, that what you're going to utilize the body for is the mechanism that can open a gateway into the heavenly realms. And this is why in so many instances, for example, I cite the transfiguration scenes and ascension scenes of Jesus, where he's being held aloft in a by angels, and behind him is a tunnel of concentric rings. When you look at those images, you see Jesus in his transfigured form as a being of light, which is the first step towards opening these gateways, and then you see the gateway behind him. And what is inferred in these images is that he is apprehended or utilized the body as a technology for lifting the divine spark into the heavenly realms. In fact, this is that controversial gospel, the Gospel of Judas, which just came out earlier this year, makes it explicit that the Savior to the Gnostics was not the physical body of Jesus. The Savior to them was considered what they referred to as the divine spark or the divine particle within Jesus. And the body is a simple covering for that divine particle.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different Gnosticisms, and I always have to feel like we have to be clear about that. There were, in many cases, as many denominations, if you will, of Gnosticism as there are, you know, today amongst Christians. There wasn't always continuity, but one of the main ones were those who saw the human body as a kind of a meat sack around this divine spark, and that this was, as you talked about before, the kind of a process that we're going through where we're reconnecting something which at one time had been our birthright, a kind of divine mind that we had that was connected all the time. What do you see, though? I mean, take us through, like, maybe what would be sort of a step-by-step process of one of these divine extractions. I mean, what do you think happened? I mean, as you investigated, as you imagine it, what happened?
Well, I have a DVD presentation available on my site called The Light Body Effect. And in that presentation, I walk the viewer to the best of my ability through this process. And actually, based on my own intuition linked with some Tibetan research, I came up with a formula. It's very simple. It's imagine it, believe it, live it. The Tibetans teach that in order to begin this process, you first have to be able to imagine it. You have to imagine that your body is, in fact, in a pupil form right now, and that there is a higher being within you referred to as the divine spark or the divine particle. And step one is imagining that and being able to connect with it. You also want to be able to imagine using visual cues. And remember, all of these teachings are taught purely in visual terms. There are no books that teach you how to do this. It was always transmitted orally and in pictures.
Do you have an example of that? I mean, do you have of what you tell people to try to get them to be that imaginative? Not everybody, I think, have that vocabulary that kind of jumps to mind.
That's why I use so many slides and depictions in my work. You know, one of the key sources for this is a gentleman named Ian Baker. He wrote a book called The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple. Turns out behind the Potala Palace in Lhasa is the Dalai Lama's secret temple, and inside this temple is a mural, a 360-degree mural that depicts this process in full color of the transmutation or transfiguration, beginning with the initiate in his human form, transfiguring into what they call the rainbow body, the vortex of energy. And so by being able to follow these visual cues, the idea is that your imagination is triggered. The next step, the Tibetan said, is that you have to accept that this is our divine state and stay in that place. In other words, you have to believe it. And then the third step is to actually live your life with the expectation, the hope in your heart that you are going to be transformed into a being of light and then live that way. So imagine it, believe it, live it is the three-step process to simplify it.
Let me ask you more specifically. If you were to give somebody, say, do you ever do meditations in which you explicitly try to give the language that somebody should use to create that imagination?
I am starting to more and more, Ian. For years, I've viewed myself as the person pointing people to the door, so to speak.
Right.
I'm not a guru. I haven't affected this transmutation myself. The Dalai Lama would certainly be more prepared to teach you about it than I am. What I am doing is weaving these traditions together and painting a picture, an open-eye meditation, if you will, of this is the highest form that we see in tradition after tradition, whether you're looking in Egypt, Tibet, Christian symbolism, it doesn't matter. They all show their highest beings in exactly the same form. And that form is in their rainbow body, in their energy body, their light body. And the message that goes with it is, this is where you're going. This is where you're headed. This is what you want to focus your life on. In fact, in the Pista Sophia, which is one of the most famous Gnostic documents, Jesus tells Mary Magdalene, the other disciples, that the explicit purpose of our life is to find the purifying mysteries that will transform us into a being of pure light, so that we can go on height and inherit the light of the kingdom, which I interpret as the garden of hundreds of billions of galaxies that inhabit the known universe, but might well be the other 95% of the universe that's still dark to us.
Right. Very interesting. Well, I would think, yeah, once you've come across this, I mean, it would be like, you know, finding a treasure map or something. It would be hard if I were you and to have the insights that you're having, where you wouldn't want to go explore where that actual treasure is. Just to point other people to the treasure doesn't seem like enough. I mean, I would think you would want to have tried to have done this yourself.
I am doing it myself. But also I recognize that there's a karmic aspect to this as well. And so I have viewed myself, the service that I provide for people, I'm not a preacher, I'm a teacher. I'm a person who researches this material and presents it to others and sources that material for others. And so for me, this has been how I've been operating for the past 10 years or so, but now more and more, as I'm acquiring more knowledge about this, I'm feeling perhaps more comfortable to start perhaps suggesting ways that people can begin this process, imagine it, believe it, live it, and also getting into more detail in terms of meditations. I just did a profound workshop with Tom Kenyon, who is a sound healer, who walked us through this whole process, Ian, in an incredible way. And when I'm watching Tom's work, he's a psychotherapist, he's a brain scientist, he's a musician. He brought all this material together and took us through a big chunk of this process in terms of raising our personal energy. It was profound. And I felt as if for the first time in my life, I mean, I've lectured with the best of the best these past 10 years, and Tom Kenyon is way beyond anybody else I've ever experienced because of what he was able to make us feel inside of our bodies. That is a true master. That's a true art. And I recognize that that's not me. My service is elsewhere.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, and so we were talking about the rod. I don't think we got around much talking about the ring as much, or for that matter, how they tie into the early art, because the rod and the ring are ubiquitous up to a certain point in Christian iconography.
Here's the tie-in. In especially ancient Sumerian, Iranian, Babylonian art, you'll see gods, divine beings, who are portrayed holding a ring in their hand. They call that ring the ring of cosmic sovereignty. And what that means to me is that that being is free to do or go just about anywhere it wants to go. And the key thing here for me is I think there's a bit of a pun. When they're portrayed holding a ring, it's sort of like a wedding ring is symbolic of something else. And I think that that ring is actually symbolic of a vibration that they hold, a ring that they have, a cosmic ring or vibration that puts them in tune with all the cosmic forces and enables them to manipulate those cosmic forces, just like Jesus did with the rod when he is portrayed performing the miracles with a rod. The rod and the ring perform the same function.
And yet that whole, it brings us back to that picture the many pictures of Jesus with holding that rod and doing something which is life-changing, almost sort of a nuclear in the way in which it comes. It's sort of an atomic level. You have all this transformation that takes place at the end of that stick, at the end of that rod.
Yes, at even the molecular level. I mean, I'm viewing Jesus as a person who is so in tune with the universe that he could manipulate matter itself.
And is there any other work other than the Gnostics that back this up? I mean, do you still... Are there other groups on the planet today that practice this? Are there any? I mean, you mentioned the Tibetans, but I mean, who else is doing it? Seemingly so easy to access it. Somebody's got to be doing it.
Well, yeah, we're kind of going about it in a different way. I mean, I think that the people that are practicing this today are at places like Fermilab in Batavia, Illinois, the particle accelerator near Chicago.
Right.
I think they're the high-energy physicists, the high priests of high-energy physics at CERN. I think that we're going about it in this way because we think that we need to have technology as our aid. But I don't know if that's necessarily so.
Well, I mean, but the ancients who did it weren't the ancient scientists. They were the ancient practitioners of religion or of mysticism. So I guess I'm saying, aren't there any religious cults other than scientists, which, you know, you could argue have their own sort of cultic beliefs, but I mean, where they're actually doing anything like this that they don't use, they don't need the billions of dollars that it takes to build accelerator.
The Tibetans still practice the great perfection. I mean, it's been in modern times up until the 1940s and 1950s, we're told that witnesses have seen Tibetan lamas transform themselves into vortexes of energy. So this isn't something that's going on in the ancient world. It's going on today. And in fact, the Dalai Lama proclaims that this is the latent capability within all sentient beings and has the hope in his heart that these teachings will become popular in the West.
I'd like to see that on a videotape. I'd like to see that. I really would. I mean, I mean, if you can't travel there, you think they'd be selling those because that'd be something I would pay cash money to watch.
The Last Mimsy is an incredible movie that's out right now. I had a line in my book, Blue Apples, about Rennes Le Château. I wrote it back in 2000 about these extraterrestrial blue stones that can be used to open holes in space and transfigure humans into beings of light. And it was three sentences in that book. And when I went to see the movie The Last Mimsy, I saw my sentences brought to life by the magic of Hollywood and was absolutely blown away because these kids in this movie get a hold of some blue stones that came from a future civilization, time travelers, and they used it to open holes in space and to dematerialize their bodies into light.
And that was what was in your book. Did they actually use any words from your book?
They didn't use any words. I mean, this happens to me a lot. I have Hollywood writers tell me that they use my stuff, and it's cool by me. I've consulted with actors before, and it's just something that I really enjoy doing. And I can't claim that The Last Mimsy has utilized those sentences from my book, but I did write about those exact same those same set of symbols.
Interesting. We'll come back coming up for our last hour with William Henry. We're going to open up all the phones. We'll give you all the numbers. And I'm not sure where this is going to go. William, do you see a particular way that you hope this last hour will go, a direction perhaps of questions or of your research?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk just a little bit more about what's going on at CERN and the search for the God particle and why it's important for us to have a spiritual basis for this transformation that we're all undergoing right now.
That's good that you said that because we did mention that earlier in the hour that we would get back to the God particle and we didn't. So we'll lead off the next hour doing that and we'll give you all your numbers for you to join the conversation too with William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet.